السلام عليكم. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. I have this huge clock here. That's great. I need my watch. This is a very important question, how Muslims can kind of configure their minds for dealing with the challenges they face, that we face today. When I talk to Muslim students or Muslim audiences, the main point I try to get across to them as they, you know, as we all confront and deal with the endless stream of media news reports about, you know, Muslim does this, this horrible thing happens in Muslim country, you know, Muslim does this attack, Muslim says that thing. And one of the, it's kind of overwhelming. It's just constant expression of how Islam is a problematic religion, how Muslims are a problematic community. The thing that I always tell Muslim students is, you are not the problem. Muslims are not the problem. Islam is not the problem. And it's hard to believe this considering the amount of attention that Muslims and Islam get, negative attention. But Muslims and Islam are not the problem. I want to explain why that is. And I'll do it by referring to an excellent book. I really urge you all to read this book. It's well written, it's relatively short, and it's fascinating. It's called On the Muslim Question, On the Muslim Question by Ann Norton. On the Muslim Question by Ann Norton. I really urge you to read this book. What she demonstrates in the book is that the Muslim problem, the problem of Islam, the problem of Muslims, is not really about Muslims at all. It's not about Islam at all. It's about the Western inability to deal with the internal contradictions of Western civilization. It's about people in the West's anxiety over their own identity. So Muslims are the screen on which those anxieties are projected. Muslims are the vehicle by which this internal concern over contradiction is voiced. And before it was Muslims, well, actually, it's been Muslims since the beginning of Islam, but it's also, especially in Europe, been Jews. So you may have heard of the book on the Jewish question that was written by Karl Marx. Well, Norton's book is showing that just like Jews, Muslims are a problem for the West because they show the West its own internal contradictions, the contradictions between its ideals and its reality. Just give a couple of examples. For example, the obsession over freedom of speech when it comes to Muslims and Islam. The idea that Muslims somehow don't understand freedom of speech. We saw this, we continue to see this constantly expressed in the media in the West. This isn't really about what Muslims think about freedom of speech. This isn't really about Islam and whether Islam can handle freedom of speech or not. This is about the fact that in the West, freedom of speech isn't offered equally to all communities. Freedom of speech becomes a shield or a rubric under which the majority denies the rights of minorities to the same level of respect in the public space. And I'll just give some examples of this. When the Charlie Hebdo attacks happened a few years ago in Paris, the next day, the days after that, there were all these images of legions of French people standing out, holding up pens, saying, "Je suis Charlie," freedom of speech. You know, there were cartoons where, you know, pens were breaking terrorist bullets and terrorist missiles and things like that. Just a few days after that, just a few days after the attack, a French comedian, Dieudonné Mbala Bala, was arrested for hate speech and was prevented from performing his comic act because, to quote the French court, his words were going to prove a grave threat to public order. A grave threat to public order. I'll tell you something else that was a grave threat to public order. Charlie Hebdo's cartoons. But were they prevented from publishing? No, absolutely not. But when a minority, when a Muslim member of a minority is saying things that are considered controversial, then he has to be silenced. And in the weeks after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, over 50 Muslims in France were arrested, 50 French citizens were arrested because they had expressed understanding of why the attacks had taken place. They didn't do anything. They had just expressed their understanding of the motivations of the terrorists. So you see here, right, just as people are out there saying, Je suis Charlie, freedom of speech, people in their own country, Muslims in their own country, citizens of their own country are being arrested for expression, for only the freedom of expression. An example of this in the United States, which, by the way, has a much stronger rule of law protection for freedom of speech than European countries, thank God. Okay, but think about all the, we hear constantly now of Republicans proposing that Muslims coming into the country should be asked to, you know, what are their views on Sharia law? Are they going to denounce Sharia law? You know, try being a Muslim, which you are, you know, try being a Muslim and saying something positive about Sharia law. Try going out in front of a group of people saying, I embrace Sharia law. Think about the kind of abuse you'll get. Think about the kind of threats that'll put you under in terms of your employment, in terms of your reputation. But if you go, you know, if you go online, just Google, does the Constitution, does the Constitution overrule the Bible? Just Google that. And you find all these websites of American Christians saying, absolutely not. It's unacceptable for any man-made document to overrule the Bible. Even Ben Carson, the former presidential candidate, now he's going to be the secretary of I don't know what, okay? He was asked on Meet the Press by Chuck Todd about a year and a half ago, does the Constitution overrule the Bible? He said, well, it really depends. You know, it depends certain parts of the Bible, certain parts of the Constitution. Try being a Muslim and getting up there and asking for that amount of time in your explanation about whether the Sharia law overrules the Constitution. So here, think about just this. Freedom of speech isn't just about what you say. It's also your right to remain silent. Freedom of speech is also the freedom not to speak. But we Muslims know that Muslims don't get that right because they're always demanded. It's always demanded of them to condemn this, to condemn that, to speak out against this, speak out against that. I don't even need to tell this audience that. Do white people have to condemn crazy lone gunmen who shoot up schools? Do white people have to condemn racists who shoot up churches in North Carolina? No, they don't. But Muslims, if they don't speak out and condemn things, they're assumed to be supportive of them. So this refusal to deny the same freedom of speech to Muslims is because freedom of speech really functions to protect the majority. Other issues in which the Muslim problem really masks or even expresses internal anxieties over the fault lines in Western civilization and Western identity is the issue of women and sexuality. The obsession, the absolute obsession in Western history with Muslim sexuality. It is outsourcing Western anxiety over our own inability to deal with issues of gender. For example, if a Muslim man kills a Muslim woman, it's automatically an honor killing, automatically. So that's just until someone proves otherwise. Have you ever heard of when a woman gets killed in the United States, have you ever heard this talked about as an issue of violence against women? No, it's a crime. It's a murder. It's a specific crime is discussed. It's never discussed as part of an issue of violence against women. But when Muslims do things, not only is it an issue of violence against women, of oppression of women, it's an issue specific to Islam, that Muslims and Islam have a particular problem with violence against women. And for me, I was so stunned. I went to India in 2012. Okay, I have a PhD, I'm a professor, so I'm a decently educated person. I went to India in 2012. I read about something called dowry killings. I didn't even know these existed. So every year in India, there are between 4,000 and 8,000 dowry killings. That means a wife is killed by her husband or her husband's family because of some shortcoming in her being a wife, basically. And it's very rarely investigated by the police. The number of doubt, remember last summer there was a woman who was killed in Pakistan by her brother? Tragically, she was murdered by her brother in Pakistan. There was a whole article on this in The Economist that week. I just Googled that, recent dowry killings in India. There were 3 dowry killings in India just that month. No one even, never came up in the media outside of India, period. So there's this obsession with Muslim violence against women, and the assumption is that it's because of Islam or because of something wrong with Muslim culture. But when you put all the attention on Muslims, what it means is that the actual problem goes unaddressed. The problem of violence against women as a human problem, as a problem that all human communities suffer with. By the way, what are the places in the world with the highest rate of violence against women? Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador. These are the countries in the world with the highest rates of what's called femicide, or murder of women because they're women. Does anyone talk about that? Does anyone know that? No, because there's this obsession with Muslims. So Muslims become the scapegoat so that no one else has to look at their own problems. Of course, there's the obsession with Muslim violence. And again, when you think of when Muslims become the violent people, when Islam is the cause of violence, no one has to look at the violence that they wreak. So, you don't even have to Google. I'm sure if you just go to some random web page, there'll be a story of some terrorist attack or of some Muslim killing somebody. Since the beginning of the war on terror in 2001, in 2015, an organization called Physicians for Social Responsibility, Physicians for Social Responsibility, issued a report, 2015. Looking at how many people have been killed in the war on terror in just 3 countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan. They calculated conservatively that 1.5 million people had been killed by the United States and its allies in the war on terror. 1.5 million people, the vast, vast majority of whom are civilians. Do Americans even think about that? No. They don't even, you go and watch movies like American Sniper, which is a really terrible movie. I saw it on the airplane. But that is the dumbest movie I've seen in my whole life, I have to say. I couldn't believe when I was watching it, I was like, this is like some guy grunting about, he doesn't even talk, he just grunts. It's a really weird movie. But people watch this movie, it doesn't, every once in a while there's, he's kind of sad he had to kill a kid, but he only had to kill the kid because the kid was a terrorist. So the idea of Americans have is that, sometimes, we kill civilians, but we have to. We have to. But Muslims are the ones who engage in gratuitous violence. They're the ones who really just kill innocent people for no reason. So this obsession with the idea that Muslims are violent, that inherently something's wrong with their religion that causes them to be violent, it gives us a free pass on coming to terms with our own, the violence and the death that we cause in the United States, which is, by the way, numerically vastly superior, vastly higher in number than any deaths caused by Muslim organizations today. And think about the issue of violence and Muslim youth. Teenage boys are well known to be the stupidest group of people in the world. I say this as a former teenage boy. And teenage boys out there, it's okay, it's not your fault, you'll grow out of it. Nobody on earth thinks that teenage boys make good decisions. And when a young white guy gets a tattoo, he's just making a bad decision. When a young, when a college student starts wearing Che Guevara t-shirts and talking about how he's against the system and things like that, everyone's like, that's okay. If a young Muslim talks about how they're upset about injustices around the world, or they're upset about what's happening in Palestine, they're upset about what's happening in Burma, suddenly this is a security concern. And CVE programs, countering violent extremism, have to start looking into this person because it might be a terrorist. So even the political awakening of a young Muslim person, usually a male in this case, looking out in the world and saying, there's things I don't like, there's things that are wrong, there's things that go against my values, there's things that go against American values, I want to speak out against these things. for any other minority or any other person, especially a majority white person, this is simply expected. For a Muslim, it's a security concern. It's important that Muslims recognize this. It's important that Muslims recognize that they are not the problem, that Islam is not the problem, for two reasons. One, because it helps, it removes this massive burden from your back. Okay, you are not, this evil force that's portrayed on television and the media of Muslims and Islam, that's not Muslims, that's not us. We're not the problem. Islam is not the problem. I have no problem saying that as a Muslim. I have absolutely no problem saying, I am not the problem, Muslims aren't the problem, Islam is not the problem. I have no problem saying that. So first of all, it frees us from that burden. And the second thing, it really helps us help other people. It helps us help the majority in this country. Because Muslims and Islam have been made the mirror in which others see their discolorations, their flaws. And that makes them hate Islam. That makes them hate Muslims. Muslims are the lens through which the West expresses its own anxieties about itself. Instead of allowing people to blame us, use us to kind of exercise these anxieties, we need to hold this mirror up to them and say, look at the contradictions here. Look at the contradictions here. Why is it that my rights as a Muslim for freedom of speech aren't the same as yours? Why is it that my rights to believe in a certain vision of God and God's law aren't the same as yours? Why is it my rights to have political opinions aren't the same as yours? Not only does that, if people believe in the ideals of democracy and constitutional rights or freedom of speech, freedom of expression, freedom of religion, which I believe Americans do, not only do we help them achieve those ideals, or at least a better approach those ideals, but we also help this country, and especially in Europe, which is a much more serious problem, we help West come to terms with its single most enduring problem, which is its inability to deal with real internal diversity. Its inability to deal with real internal diversity. When the French public, or a large portion of the French public, says, we think it's important to draw insulting pictures of the Prophet because we want to insist on the right of freedom of speech, and we think people should accept that other people have the right to insult them because that's part of freedom of speech, that's part of the West. And when Muslims say, look, we know you have that right, when Muslim people in France, most French Muslims say, we know you have that right, but this hurts us. Why do you want to hurt us? We're fellow French people, we're fellow French citizens, why do you want to hurt us? And when that public says, we have to hurt you because it's freedom of speech, that's not really standing up for freedom of speech. It's not a courageous stand for freedom of speech to say, I'm going to protect my right to insult a beleaguered, tiny minority. It's not courageous for, like, Bill Maher to say he's standing up for liberalism because he's standing up for his right to insult Muslims. Insulting Muslims is really easy. You can do it on TV all day and nothing will happen to you. For God's sake, the president of the United States, future president of the United States, insulted Muslims constantly. He insulted all these minorities constantly in his campaign and nothing happened to him. He was still elected. It is not courageous to say that insulting people who are unempowered, who are besieged, it is not courageous to insult them. It's courageous to stand up for the unempowered. It's a courageous stand up for the weak and to tell a majority, a powerful majority, that it can't say these things. That's courage. Muslims can help this country and also other Western countries by not giving in to demands to assimilate. There is nothing in the American Constitution There's nothing in the values of the United States that I know of that says that people have to give up their religious beliefs, that says that people have to give up their cultural markers, that they have to give up their ways of dress, that they have to give up their food, that they have to give up their political values. There's nothing I know of that says you have to do that in order to become American. So if we give in, if we give in to pressure and assimilate, you know, start calling ourselves Mark instead of Mohammed, you know, if we start doing that, we're not doing anybody any favors. We're not standing up for any value. We're going to lose our own identity, and we're going to lose the chance to remind others around us that being American doesn't mean dressing like a preppy white guy. It means standing up for freedom of religion, freedom of expression, accountable government, transparent government, freedom of association. We have the chance to remind people of that. But we need to stop thinking of ourselves as the problem and start seeing ourselves as a reflection of problems in our society that actually have nothing to do with us. Jazakumullah khair.